okay, he said. He stopped and turned to face forward, but he left his arm draped around her shoulders. She was heading east on Chestnut. As they came to the bridge, he said, take the expressway. There's something I want to show you. Following the signs, she turned right onto Schuylkill Avenue and pulled up at a stoplight. The hand over her shoulder dropped lower, and he started fondling her breast. She felt her nipples stiffen in response to his touch, but all the same, she felt uncomfortable. It was strangely like being felt up on a subway train. She said, Steve, I like you, but you're going a little too fast for me. He made no reply, but his fingers found her nipple and pinched it hard. Ow, she said. That hurt. For Pete's sake, what's got into you? She shoved him away with her right hand. The light turned green, and she drove down the on-ramp for the Schuylkill Expressway. I don't know where I am with you, he complained. First you kiss me like a nymphomaniac, then you freeze. And I imagined this boy was mature. Listen, a girl kisses you because she wants to kiss you. It's not a license for you to do anything the hell you want to her, and you should never hurt. She eased onto the southbound two-lane of the expressway. Some girls like to be hurt, he said, putting a hand on her knee. She moved his hand. What do you want to show me anyway, she said, trying to distract him. This, he said, taking her right hand. A moment later, she felt his naked penis, stiff and hot. Jesus Christ! She snatched her hand away. Boy, had she misjudged this one. Put it away, Steve, and stop acting like a goddamned adolescent. The next thing she knew, something struck her with a mighty blow on the side of the face. She screamed and jerked sideways. An air horn blared as her car swung across the next lane of the expressway in front of a Mack truck. The bones of her face burned with agony, and she tasted blood. Fighting to ignore the pain, she regained control of the car. She realized with astonishment that he had punched her. No one had ever done that. You son of a bitch! She screamed. Now give me a hand job, he said. Otherwise, I'll beat the shit out of you. Fuck you, she yelled. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw him draw back his fist for another blow. Without thinking, she stepped on the brake. He was thrown forward, and his punch missed her. His head banged the windshield. Tires screeched in protest as a white stretch limousine swerved to avoid the Mercedes. As he recovered his balance, she released the brake. The car coasted forward. If she stopped in the fast lane of the expressway for a few seconds, she thought, he would be so terrified he would plead with her to drive on. She stepped on the brake once more, throwing him forward again. This time, he recovered more quickly. The car came to a halt. Cars and trucks swerved around it, horns blaring. Jeannie was terrified. At any moment, another vehicle could slam into the back of the Mercedes. But her plan did not work. He seemed to have no fear. He put his hand up her skirt, grasped the waist of her pantyhose, and pulled. There was a tearing sound as her tights ripped open. She tried to push him away, but he was all over her. Surely he would not try to rape her right there on the expressway. In despair, she opened her door, but she could not get out because she had her seatbelt fastened. She tried to undo it, but she could not get at the buckle because of Steve. To her left, traffic was joining the expressway from another ramp, coming directly into the fast lane at 60 miles an hour and flashing by. Was there not a single driver who would stop and help a woman who was being attacked? As she struggled to push him away, her foot came off the brake and the car crept forward. Maybe she could keep him off balance, she thought. She had control of the car. It was her only advantage. In desperation, she put her foot on the accelerator pedal and floored it. The car took off with a lurch. Brakes squealed as the Greyhound bus narrowly missed her fender. Steve was thrown back in his seat and distracted briefly. But a few seconds later, his hands were all over her again, pulling her breasts out of her brassiere and thrusting inside her panties as she tried to drive. She was frantic. He did not seem to care if he killed both of them. What the hell could she do to stop him? She swung the car hard across to the left, throwing him up against the passenger door. She almost hit a garbage truck, and for a cliff-hanging instant, she looked into the petrified face of the driver, an elderly man with a gray mustache. Then she swung the wheel the other way, and the Mercedes lurched out of danger. Steve grabbed her again. She braked hard, then floored the accelerator, but he laughed as he was thrown around, just as if he were on a joyride at a carnival. And then he came back at her. She hit him with her right elbow and her fist, but she could not put any power into the blows while she was at the wheel, and she succeeded only in distracting him for a few more seconds. How long could this go on? Were there no cop cars in this town? Over his shoulder, she saw that she was passing an off-ramp. There was an ancient sky-blue Cadillac on her near side, a few yards behind her. At the last moment, she swung the steering wheel. Her tires screeched. The Mercedes went up on two wheels, and Steve fell against her helplessly. The blue Cadillac swerved to avoid her. There was a fanfare of outraged car horns. Then she heard the thud of cars crashing and the xylophone sound of breaking glass. Her nearside wheels came down again, and she hit the tarmac with a bone-shuddering thump. End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over. Side 7. The Third Twin by Ken Follett. Continuing on page 242. She was on the ramp. The car fishtailed, threatening to hit the concrete parapet on either side, but she got it straight. She accelerated down a long off-ramp. As soon as the car was stable, Steve thrust his hand between her legs and attempted to get his fingers inside her panties. She wriggled, trying to stop him. She glanced at his face. He was smiling, his eyes wide, panting and sweating with sexual excitement. He was having fun. This was crazy. There were no cars ahead or behind her. The ramp ended in a stoplight, which was green. To her left was a cemetery. She saw a sign pointing right that read, Civic Center Boulevard, and she swung that way, hoping to see a busy town hall with crowds of people on the sidewalk. To her dismay, the street was a bleak desert of unused halls and concrete plazas. Ahead of her, a light turned red. If she stopped, she was done for. Steve got his hand inside her panties and said, Stop the car! Like her, he had realized that if he raped her here, there was a good chance no one would interfere. He was hurting her now, pinching and thrusting with his fingers, but worse than the pain was the fear of what was to come. She accelerated wildly toward the red light. An ambulance came from the left, swinging in front of her. She braked hard and swerved to miss it, thinking crazily, If I crash now, at least help is at hand. Suddenly, Steve withdrew his hands from her body. She had a moment of blessed relief. Then he grabbed the transmission lever and pushed it into neutral. The car suddenly lost momentum. She yanked it back into drive and floored the pedal, passing the ambulance. How long can this go on? Jeannie thought. She had to get to a neighborhood where there were some people before the car stopped or crashed. But Philadelphia had turned into a moonscape. He grabbed the steering wheel and tried to pull the car over onto the sidewalk. Jeannie jerked it back quickly. The rear wheel skidded, and the ambulance honked indignantly. He tried again. This time he was cleverer. He knocked the transmission into neutral with his left hand and grabbed the wheel with his right. The car slowed down and mounted the curb. Jeannie took both hands off the wheel, put them on Steve's chest, and shoved him away with all her might. Her strength surprised him, and he was flung backward. She put the car in drive and stamped on the accelerator pedal. The car rocketed forward yet again, but Jeannie knew that she could not fight him off much longer. Any second now, he would succeed in stopping the car, and she would be trapped in here with him. He recovered his balance as she turned into a left-hand bend. He got both hands on the steering wheel, and she thought, This is the end. I can't do any more. Then the car rounded the bend, and the cityscape changed abruptly. There was a busy street, a hospital with people standing outside, a line of taxi cabs, and a sidewalk stall selling Chinese food. Yes! Jeannie shouted triumphantly. She stamped on the brake. Steve jerked the wheel, and she pulled it back. Fishtailing, the car screeched to a halt in the middle of the road. A dozen cab drivers at the food stand turned to look. Steve opened his door, got out, and ran. Thank God, Jeannie breathed. A moment later, he had disappeared. Jeannie sat there panting. He was gone. The nightmare was over. One of the drivers came over and put his head inside the passenger door. Hastily, Jeanie rearranged her clothing. "Are you okay, lady?" he said.
"I guess so," she replied breathlessly.
"What the heck was that all about?"
She shook her head. "I sure wish I knew," she said.
36. Steve sat on a low wall near Jeanie's house, waiting for her. It was hot, but he took advantage of the shade of a big maple tree. She lived in an old working-class neighborhood of traditional row houses. Teenagers from a nearby school were walking home, laughing and quarreling and eating candy. It was not long since he had been like that, 8 or 9 years. But now he was worried and desperate. This afternoon, his lawyer had talked to Sergeant Delaware of the Sex Crimes Unit in Baltimore. She had told him she had the results of the DNA test. The DNA from traces of sperm in Lisa Hoxton's vagina exactly matched the DNA in Steve's blood. He was devastated. He had been sure the DNA test would end this agony. He could tell that his lawyer no longer believed in his innocence. Mom and Dad did, but they were baffled. They both knew enough to realize that DNA testing was extremely reliable. In his worst moments, he wondered if he had some kind of split personality. Maybe there was another Steve who took over and raped women and gave him his body back afterward. That way, he would not know what he had done. He recalled, ominously, that there were a few seconds of his fight with Tip Hendricks that he had never been able to bring to mind, and he had been ready to drive his fingers into Porky Butcher's brain. Was it his alter ego who did these things? He did not really believe it. There had to be another explanation. The ray of hope was the mystery surrounding him and Dennis Pinker. Dennis had the same DNA as Steve. Something was wrong here, and the only person who could figure it out was Jeanie Ferrami. The kids disappeared into their homes, and the sun dipped behind the row of houses on the other side of the street. Toward 6 o'clock, the red Mercedes eased into a parking slot 50 yards away. Jeanie got out. At first, she did not see Steve. She opened the trunk and took out a large black plastic garbage bag. Then she locked the car and came along the sidewalk toward him. She was dressed formally in a black skirted suit, but she looked disheveled, and there was a weariness in her walk that touched his heart. He wondered what had happened to give her this battle-worn look. She was still gorgeous, though, and he watched her with longing in his heart. As she got near him, he stood up, smiling, and took a step toward her. She glanced at him, met his eye, and recognized him. A look of horror came over her face. She opened her mouth and screamed. He stopped dead. Aghast, he said, "Jeanie, what is it?" "Get away from me," she yelled. "Don't you touch me. I'm calling the cops right now." Nonplussed, Steve held his hands up in a defensive gesture. "Sure, sure, anything you say. I'm not touching you, okay?" "What the hell has gotten into you?" A neighbor came out of the front door Jeanie shared. He must be the occupant of the apartment beneath hers, Steve figured. He was an old black man wearing a checked shirt and a tie.
"Is everything all right, Jeanie?" he said. "I thought I heard someone cry out."
"It was me, Mr. Oliver," she said in a shaky voice. "This jerk attacked me in my car in Philadelphia this afternoon."
"Attacked you?"
Steve said incredulously. "I wouldn't do that." "You bastard! You did it 2 hours ago." Steve was stung. He was sick of being accused of brutality.
"Fuck you! I haven't been to Philadelphia for years."
Mr. Oliver intervened.
"This young gentleman been sitting on that wall for nigh on 2 hours, Jeanie. He ain't been to no Philadelphia this afternoon."
Jeanie looked indignant and seemed ready to accuse her good-natured neighbor of lying. Steve noticed that she was wearing no stockings. Her bare legs looked odd with such a formal outfit. One side of her face was slightly swollen and reddish. His fury evaporated. Someone had attacked her. He yearned to put his arms around her and comfort her. It made her fear of him even more distressing. "He hurt you," he said. "The bastard." Her face changed. The look of terror went. She spoke to the neighbor. "He got here 2 hours ago?" The man shrugged.
"Hour and 40, maybe 50 minutes.
"You're sure?"
Jeannie, if he was in Philadelphia 2 hours ago, he must have come here on the Concorde.
She looked at Steve. It must have been Dennis. He walked toward her. She did not step back. He reached out and touched her swollen cheek with his fingertips. Poor Jeannie, he said. I thought it was you, she said, and tears came to her eyes. He folded her in his arms. Slowly he felt her body lose its stiffness, and she leaned on him trustingly. He stroked her head and twined his fingers in the heavy waves of her dark hair. He closed his eyes, thinking how lean and strong her body was.
I'll bet Dennis has some bruises, too, he thought. I hope so.
Mr. Oliver coughed.
Would you youngsters like a cup of coffee?
Jeannie detached herself from Steve. No, thanks, she said. I just want to get out of these clothes. Tension was written on her face, but she looked even more bewitching. I'm falling in love with this woman, he thought. It's not just that I want to sleep with her, though it's that, too. I want her to be my friend. I want to watch TV with her and go to the supermarket with her and give her NyQuil on a spoon when she has a cold. I want to see how she brushes her teeth and pulls on her jeans and butters her toast. I want her to ask me, does the orange lipstick suit her? And should she buy razors? And what time will I be home? He wondered if he had the nerve to tell her that. She crossed the row porch to her door. Steve hesitated. He wanted to follow her, but he needed an invitation. She turned on the doorstep. Come on, she said. He followed her up the stairs and entered the living room behind her. She dropped the black plastic bag on the rug. She went into the kitchen nook and kicked off her shoes. Then, to his astonishment, she dropped them in the kitchen bin. I'll never wear these goddamn clothes again, she said angrily. She took off her jacket and threw that away. Then, as Steve stared in disbelief, she unbuttoned her blouse and took it off and put that in the bin, too. She was wearing a plain black cotton brassiere. Surely, Steve thought, she was not going to take that off right in front of him. But she reached behind her back, unfastened it, and tossed it into the trash. She had firm, shallow breasts with prominent brown nipples. There was a faint red mark on her shoulder where the strap had been too tight. Steve's throat went dry. She unzipped her skirt and let it fall to the floor. She wore simple black bikini panties. Steve gazed at her, open-mouthed. Her body was perfect. The strong shoulders, the neat breasts, the flat belly, and the long, sculptured legs. She pushed her panties down, swept them up in a bundle with the skirt, and shoved the bundle into the bin. Her pubic hair was a dense mass of black curls. She looked blankly at Steve for a moment, almost as if she were not sure what he was doing there. Then she said, I have to take a shower. Naked, she walked past him. He looked hungrily at her back, drinking in the details of her shoulder blades, her narrow waist, the swelling curves of her hips and the muscles of her legs. She was so lovely, it hurt. She left the room. A moment later, he heard water running. Jesus, he breathed. He sat on her black couch. What did it mean? Was that some kind of test? What was she trying to say to him? He smiled. What a wonderful body, so slim and strong and perfectly proportioned. No matter what else happened, he would never forget the way she looked. She showered for a long time. He realized that in the drama of her accusation, he had not told her his mystifying news. At last, the water stopped. A minute later, she returned to the room in a big fuchsia-pink terry-cloth robe, wet hair plastered to her head. She sat on the couch beside him and said, Did I dream it, or did I just strip off in front of you? No dream, he said. You dumped your clothes in the trash. My God! I don't know what came over me. You don't have anything to apologize for. I'm glad you trust me so much. I can't tell you what that means to me. You must think I'm out of my mind. No, but I think you're probably shocked after what happened to you in Philadelphia.
Maybe that's it. I just remember feeling I had to get rid of the clothes I was wearing when it happened.
This may be the moment to open that bottle of vodka you keep in the freezer.
She shook her head. What I really want is some jasmine tea. Let me make it. He got up and went behind the kitchen counter. Why are you carrying a garbage bag around? I was fired today. They put all my personal stuff in that bag and locked me out of my room. What? He was incredulous. How come? There was an article in the New York Times today saying that my use of databases violates people's privacy. But I think Barrington Jones was just using that as an excuse to get rid of me. He burned with indignation. He wanted to protest, to spring to her defense, to save her from this malicious persecution. Can they dismiss you just like that? No. There's a hearing tomorrow morning in front of the Discipline Committee of the University Senate. You and I are both having an unbelievably bad week. He was going to tell her about the DNA test when she picked up the phone. I need the number of Greenwood Penitentiary. It's near Richmond, Virginia. As Steve filled the kettle, she scribbled the number and dialed again. May I speak to Warden Des Moines? My name is Dr. Farami. Yes, I'll hold. Thank you. Good evening, Warden. How are you? I'm fine. This may sound like a silly question, but is Dennis Pinker still in jail? You're sure? You saw him with your own eyes? Thank you. And you take care of yourself, too. Bye. She looked up at Steve. Dennis is still in jail. The warden spoke to him an hour ago. Steve put a spoonful of jasmine tea into the pot and found two cups. Jeannie, the cops have the result of their DNA test. She went very still. And? The DNA from Lisa's vagina matches the DNA from my blood. In a bemused voice, she said, Are you thinking what I'm thinking? Someone who looks like me and has my DNA raped Lisa Hoxton on Sunday. The same guy attacked you in Philadelphia today. And it wasn't Dennis Pinker. Their eyes locked, and Jeannie said, There are three of you. Jesus Christ. He felt despairing. But this is even more unlikely. The cops will never believe it. How could something like this happen? Wait, she said excitedly. You don't know what I discovered this afternoon before I ran into your double. I have the explanation. Dear God, let this be true. She looked concerned. Steve, you're going to find it shocking. I don't care. I just want to understand. She reached into the black plastic garbage bag and retrieved a canvas briefcase. Look at this. She took out a glossy brochure folded open to the first page. She handed it to Steve, and he read the opening paragraph. The Aventine Clinic was founded in 1972 by Genetico Incorporated as a pioneering center for research and development of human in vitro fertilization, the creation of what the newspapers call test tube babies. Steve said, You think Dennis and I are test tube babies? Yes. He had a strange, nauseated feeling in the pit of his stomach. That's weird. But what does it explain? Identical twins could be conceived in a laboratory and then implanted in the wombs of different women. Steve's sick feeling got worse. But did the sperm and egg come from Mom and Dad? Or from the Pinkers? I don't know. So the Pinkers could be my real parents? God! There's another possibility. Steve could see from the worried look on Jeannie's face that she was afraid this would shock him, too. His mind leaped ahead, and he guessed what she was going to say. Maybe the sperm and egg didn't come from my parents or the Pinkers. I could be the child of total strangers. She did not reply, but her solemn look told him he was right. He felt disoriented. It was like a dream in which he suddenly found himself falling through the air. It's hard to take in, he said. The kettle switched itself off. For something to do with his hands, Steve poured boiling water into the teapot. I've never much resembled either Mom or Dad. Do I look like one of the Pinkers? No. Then it's most probably strangers. Steve, none of this takes away the fact that your mom and dad loved you and raised you and would still give their lives for you. With a shaky hand, he poured tea into two cups. He gave one to Jeannie and sat beside her on the couch. How does all this explain the third twin? If there were twins in the test tube, there could have been triplets. It's the same process. One of the embryos split again. It happens in nature, so I guess it can happen in the laboratory. Steve still felt as if he were spinning through the air, but now he began to get another sensation. Relief. It was a bizarre story that Jeannie told, but at least it provided a rational explanation of why he had been accused of two brutal crimes. Do Mom and Dad know any of this? I don't believe they do. Your mother and Charlotte Pinker told me they went into the clinic for hormone treatment. In vitro fertilization was not practiced in those days. Genetico must have been years ahead of everyone else with the technique, and I think they tried it without telling their patients what they were doing. No wonder Genetico is scared, Steve said. Now I understand why Barrington is so desperate to discredit you. Yeah, what they did was really unethical. It makes invasion of privacy look petty. It wasn't just unethical. It could ruin Genetico financially. She looked excited. That would explain a lot. But how could it ruin them? It's a tort, a civil wrong. We covered this last year in law school. In the back of his mind, he was thinking, why the hell am I talking to her about torts? I want to tell her how much I love her. If Genetico offered a woman hormone treatment, then deliberately impregnated her with someone else's fetus without telling her, that's a breach of implied contract by fraud. But it happened so long ago. Isn't there a statute of limitations? Yes, but it runs from the time of discovery of the fraud. I still don't see how it would ruin the company. This is an ideal case for punitive damages. That means the money is not just to compensate the victim, say for the cost of bringing up someone else's child. It's also to punish the people who did it and make sure they and others are scared to commit the same wrong again. How much? Genetico knowingly abused a woman's body for their own secret purposes. I'm sure any lawyer worth his salt would ask for $100 million. According to that piece in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, the entire company is only worth $180 million. So they would be ruined. It might take years to come to trial. But don't you see? Just the threat would sabotage the takeover. How so? The danger that Genetico may have to pay a fortune in damages reduces the value of the shares. The takeover would at least be postponed until Landsman could assess the amount of the liability. Wow, so it's not just their reputations that are on the line. They could lose all that money, too. Exactly. Steve's mind came back to his own problems. None of this helps me, he said, suddenly feeling gloomy again. I need to be able to prove your theory of the third twin. The only way of doing that is to find him. A thought struck him. Could your computer search engine be used? Do you see what I mean? Sure. He grew excited. If one search threw up me and Dennis, another search might throw up me and the third, or Dennis and the third, or all three of us. Yes. She was not as thrilled as she ought to be. Can you do it? After this bad publicity, I'm going to have trouble getting anyone to let me use their database. Damn. But there is one possibility. I've already run a sweep of the FBI fingerprint file. Steve's spirits rocketed again. Dennis is sure to be on their files. If the third one has ever had his prints taken, the sweep will have picked him up. This is great! But the results are on a floppy disk in my office. Oh, no. And you've been locked out. Yes. Hell, I'll bust down the door. Let's go there now. What are we waiting for? You could end up back in jail. And there may be an easier way. With an effort, Steve calmed down. You're right. There has to be another way of getting that disk. Jeannie picked up the phone. I asked Lisa Hoxton to try to get into my office. Let's see if she succeeded. She dialed a number. Hey, Lisa, how are you? Me? Not too good. Listen, this is going to sound incredible to you. She summarized what she had found out. I know it's hard to believe, but I can prove it if I can get my hands on that floppy disk. You couldn't get into my office? Shit. Jeannie's face fell. Well, thanks for trying. I know you took a chance. I really appreciate it. Yeah. Bye. She hung up and said, Lisa tried to persuade a security guard to let her in. She almost succeeded. Then he checked with his superior and almost got fired.
What do we try next?
If I get my job back tomorrow morning at the hearing, I can just walk into my office. Who's your lawyer?
I don't have a lawyer. I've never needed one. You can bet the college will have the most expensive lawyer in town.
Shit, I can't afford a lawyer. Steve hardly dared to say what was in his mind.
Well, I'm a lawyer.
She looked speculatively at him.
I've only done a year of law school, but in our advocacy exercises, I scored highest in my class.
He was thrilled by the idea of defending her against the might of Jones Falls University, but would she think him too young and inexperienced? He tried to read her mind and failed. She kept looking at him. He stared right back, gazing into her dark eyes.
I could do this indefinitely, he thought.
Then she leaned over and kissed him on the lips, lightly and fleetingly. Hell, Steve, you're the real thing, she said. It was a very quick kiss, but it was electric. He felt great. He was not sure what she meant by the real thing, but it must be good. He would have to justify her faith in him. He began to worry about the hearing. Do you have any idea of the rules of the committee, the procedure for the hearing? She reached into her canvas briefcase and handed him a cardboard folder. He scanned the contents. The rules were a mixture of college tradition and modern legal jargon. Offenses for which faculty could be dismissed included blasphemy and sodomy, but the one that seemed most relevant to Jeannie was traditional, bringing the university into infamy and disrepute. The discipline committee did not, in fact, have the final say. It merely made a recommendation to the Senate, the governing body of the university. That was worth knowing. If Jeannie lost tomorrow, the Senate might serve as a court of appeal. Do you have a copy of your contract? Steve asked. Sure. Jeannie went to a small desk in the corner and opened a file drawer. Here it is. Steve read it quickly. In Clause 12, she agreed to be bound by the decisions of the university Senate. That would make it difficult for her to legally challenge the final decision. He returned to the discipline committee rules.
It says you have to notify the chair in advance if you wish to be represented by a lawyer or other person, he said.
I'll call Jack Budgeon right away, Jeannie said. It's 8 o'clock. He'll be at home. She picked up the phone.
Wait, Steve said. Let's think about the conversation first.
You're so right. You're thinking strategically, and I'm not.
Steve felt pleased. The first piece of advice he had given as her lawyer had been good. This man holds your fate in his hands.
What's he like?
He's chief librarian and my tennis opponent.
The guy you were playing on Sunday?
Yes. An administrator, rather than an academic. A good tactical player, but my guess is he never had the killer instinct to make it to the top in tennis.
Okay, so he has a somewhat competitive relationship with you.
I guess so.
Now, what impression do we want to give him?
He ticked points on his fingers. One, we want to appear upbeat and confident of success. You're looking forward eagerly to the hearing. You're innocent, you're glad of the opportunity to prove it, and you have faith that the committee will see the truth of the matter, under Budgeon's wise direction.
Okay.
Two, you're the underdog. You're a weak, helpless girl.
Are you kidding?
He grinned.
Scratch that. You're a very junior academic, and you're up against Barrington and O'Bell. Two wily old operators who are used to getting their own way at JFU.
Hell, you can't even afford a real lawyer.
Is Budgeon Jewish?
I don't know. He might be.
I hope so. Minorities are more likely to turn against the establishment.
Three, the story of why Barrington is persecuting you like this has to come out. It's a shocking story, but it must be told.
How does it help me to say that?
It plants the idea that Barrington might have something to hide.
Good. Anything else?
I don't think so.
Jeannie dialed the number and handed him the phone. Steve took it with trepidation.
This was the first call he had ever made as someone's lawyer. Pray God I don't screw up.
As he listened to the ringing tone, he tried to recall how Jack Budgeon played tennis. Steve had been concentrating on Jeannie, of course, but he remembered a fit, bald man of about 50, playing a well-paced, wily game. Budgeon had defeated Jeannie, even though she was younger and stronger. Steve vowed not to underestimate him.
The phone was answered in a quiet, cultured voice. Hello? Professor Budgeon. My name is Stephen Logan. There was a short pause. Do I know you, Mr. Logan? No, sir. I'm calling you in your capacity as chair of the discipline committee of Jones Falls University to let you know that I'll be accompanying Dr. Farami tomorrow. She's looking forward to the hearing, and she's eager to lay these charges to rest. Budgeon's tone was cool. Are you a lawyer? Steve found his breath coming fast as if he had been running, and he made an effort to stay calm. I'm at law school. Dr. Farami can't afford a lawyer. However, I'm going to do my best to help her present her case clearly, and if I go wrong, I'll have to throw myself on your mercy. He paused, giving Budgeon the chance to make a friendly remark, or even just a sympathetic grunt, but there was a cold silence. Steve plowed on. May I ask who will be representing the college? I understand they've hired Henry Quinn from Harvey Horrocks Quinn. Steve was awestruck. It was one of the oldest firms in Washington. He tried to sound relaxed. A deeply respectable WASP law firm, he remarked with a small chuckle. Indeed. Stephen's charm was not working on this man. It was time to sound tough. One thing I should perhaps mention. We must now tell the true story of why Barrington Jones has acted against Dr. Farami in this way. We will not accept any cancellation of the hearing on any terms. That would leave a cloud over her head. The truth must come out, I'm afraid. I know of no proposal to cancel the hearing. Of course not. There was no such proposal. Steve carried on with his bravado. But if there should be one, please be advised that it would be unacceptable to Dr. Farami. He decided to wind this up before he got himself in too deep. Professor, I thank you for your courtesy, and I look forward to seeing you in the morning. Goodbye. Steve hung up. Wow, what an iceberg! Jeannie looked puzzled. He's not normally like that. Maybe he was just being formal. Steve was pretty sure Budgeon had already made up his mind and was hostile to Jeannie, but he did not tell her that. Anyway, I got our 3 points across, and I discovered that JFU has hired Henry Quinn. Is he good? He was legendary. It made Steve go cold to think he was going to go up against Henry Quinn, but he did not want to depress Jeannie. Quinn used to be very good, but he may be past his prime. She accepted that. What should we do now? Steve looked at her. The pink bathrobe had gaped open at the front, and he could see one neat breast nestling in the folds of soft terry cloth. We should go over the questions you'll be asked at the hearing, he said regretfully. We've got a lot of work to do tonight. 37. Jane Edelsborough looked a lot better naked than she did dressed. She lay on a pale pink sheet, lit by the flame of a scented candle. Her clear, soft skin was more attractive than the muddy earth colors she always wore. The loose clothes she favored tended to hide her body. She was something of an Amazon, with a deep bosom and broad hips. She was heavy, but it suited her. Lying on the bed, she smiled languidly at Barrington as he pulled on his blue boxer shorts. Wow, that was better than I expected, she said. Barrington felt the same, although he was not crass enough to say so. Jane knew things that he normally had to teach to the younger women he usually took to bed. He wondered idly where she had learned to be such a good lay. She had been married once. Her husband, a cigarette smoker, had died of lung cancer 10 years ago. They must have had a great sex life together. He had enjoyed it so much that he had not needed his usual fantasy, in which he had just made love to a famous beauty, Cindy Crawford or Bridget Fonda or Princess Diana, and she was lying beside him, murmuring in his ear, "Thank you, Barry. That was the best it's ever been for me. You're so great. Thank you." "I feel so guilty," Jane said. "I haven't done anything this wicked for a long time." "Wicked?" he said, tying his shoelaces. "I don't see why. You're free, white, and 21, as we used to say." He noticed her wince. The phrase, free, white, and 21, was now politically incorrect. "You're single, anyway," he added hastily. Oh, it's not the fucking that was wicked, she said languorously. It's just that I know you only did it because I'm on the committee for tomorrow's hearing. He froze in the act of putting on his striped necktie. She went on. I'm supposed to think you saw me across the student cafeteria and became entranced by my sexual magnetism? She smiled ruefully at him. I don't have any sexual magnetism, Barry. Not for someone as superficial as you. You had to have an ulterior motive, and it took me about 5 seconds to figure out what it could be. Barrington felt a fool. He did not know what to say. Now in your case, you do have sexual magnetism. Buckets. You've got charm and a nice body. You dress well and you smell good. Most of all, anyone can see that you really like women. You may manipulate them and exploit them, but you love them too. You are the perfect one-night stand. And I thank you. With that, she pulled the sheet over her naked body, rolled onto her side, and closed her eyes. Barrington finished dressing as quickly as he could. Before he left, he sat on the edge of the bed. She opened her eyes. He said, Will you support me tomorrow? She sat upright and kissed him fondly. I'll have to listen to the evidence before I make up my mind, she said. He ground his teeth. It's terribly important to me, more than you know. She nodded sympathetically, but her reply was implacable. I guess it's just as important to Jeannie Ferrami. He squeezed her left breast, soft and heavy. But who is more important to you, Jeannie or me? I know what it's like to be a young woman academic in a male-dominated university. I'll never forget that. Shit. He took his hand away. You could stay the night, you know. Then we could do it again in the morning. He stood up. I've got too much on my mind. She closed her eyes. That's too bad. He went out. His car was parked in the driveway of her suburban house, next to her Jaguar. That Jaguar should have been a warning to me, he thought, a sign that there is more to her than meets the eye. He had been used, but he had enjoyed it. He wondered if women sometimes felt that way after he seduced them. As he drove home, he worried about tomorrow's hearing. He had the four men on the committee on his side, but he had failed to win a promise of support from Jane. Was there anything else he could do? At this late stage, there did not seem to be. When he got home, there was a message from Jim Proust on his answering machine. Not more bad news, please, he thought. He sat at the desk in his den and called Jim's home. This is Barry. The FBI fucked up, Jim said without preamble. Barrington's spirit sank further. Tell me. They were told to cancel that search, but the order didn't get through in time. God damn. The results were sent to her by email. He felt afraid. Who was on the list? We don't know. The Bureau didn't keep a copy. This was insupportable. We have to know. Maybe you can find out. The list could be in her office. She's locked out of her office. Barrington was struck by a hopeful thought. She might not have retrieved her mail. His mood lifted a little. Can you do that? Sure. Barrington looked at his gold Rolex. I'll go into the college right now. Call me as soon as you know. You bet. He got back in his car and drove to Jones Falls University. The campus was dark and deserted. He parked outside Nuthouse and went in. He felt less embarrassed about sneaking into Jeannie's office the second time. What the hell? There was too much at stake for him to worry about his dignity. He turned on her computer and accessed her mailbox. She had one piece of mail. Please, God, let this be the FBI list. He downloaded it. To his disappointment, it was another message from her friend at the University of Minnesota. Did you get my email yesterday? I'll be in Baltimore tomorrow and would really like to see you again, even if only for a few minutes. Please call me. Love, Will. She had not got yesterday's message because Barrington had downloaded it, then erased it. She would not get this one either. But where was the FBI list? She must have downloaded it yesterday morning before security locked her out. Where had she saved it? Barrington searched her hard disk for the words FBI, FBI with dots, and Federal Bureau of Investigation. He found nothing. He searched through a box of diskettes in her drawer, but they were just backups of the files on her computer.
This woman even keeps a backup copy of her goddamn shopping list, he muttered.
He used Jeannie's phone to call Jim again.
Nothing, he said abruptly. We have to know who is on that list, Jim barked.
Barrington said sarcastically, What shall I do, Jim? Kidnap and torture her?
She must have the list, right?
It's not in her mailbox, so she must have downloaded it.
So if it's not in her office, she must have it at home.
Logical. Barrington saw where he was heading.
Can you have her place?
He was reluctant to say, searched by the FBI on the phone.
Can you have it checked out?
I guess so. David Crean failed to deliver, so I guess he still owes me a favor.
I'll call him.
Tomorrow morning would be a good time. The hearing is at 10. She'll be there for a couple of hours.
Gotcha. I'll get it done.
But what if she keeps it in her goddamn handbag? What do we do then? I don't know. Good night, Jim.
Night.
After hanging up, Barrington sat there for a while, looking at the narrow room enlivened by Jeannie's bright, bold colors. If things went wrong tomorrow, she could be back at this desk by lunchtime, with her FBI list, charging ahead with her investigation, all set to ruin three good men. It must not happen, he thought desperately. It must not happen. Friday. 38. Jeannie woke up in her compact, white-walled living room, on her black couch, in Steve's arms, wearing only her fuchsia-pink terry-cloth bathrobe. How did I get here? They had spent half the night rehearsing for tomorrow's hearing. Jeannie's heart lurched. Her fate was to be decided this morning. But how come I'm lying in his lap? Around 3 o'clock, she had yawned and closed her eyes for a moment. And then? She must have fallen asleep. At some point, he had gone into the bedroom and taken the blue and red striped quilt off the bed and tucked it around her, for she was snug beneath it. But Steve could not be responsible for the way she was lying, with her head on his thigh and her arm around his waist. She must have done that herself, in her sleep. It was a bit embarrassing. Her face was very close to his crotch. She wondered what he thought of her. Her behavior had been very off the wall, undressing in front of him, then falling asleep on him. She was behaving as you would with a long-time lover. Well, I've got an excuse for acting weird. I've had a weird week. She had been ill-treated by Patrolman McKenty, robbed by her father, accused by the New York Times, threatened with a knife by Dennis Pinker, fired by the college, and attacked in her car. She felt damaged. Her face throbbed gently where she had been punched yesterday, but the injuries were not merely physical. The attack had bruised her psyche, too. When she recalled the fight in the car, her anger returned, and she wanted to get the man by the throat. Even when she was not remembering, she felt a low background hum of unhappiness, as if her life were somehow of less value because of the attack. It was surprising she could trust any man. Astonishing that she could fall asleep on a couch with one who looked exactly like her attackers. But now she could be even more sure of Steve. Neither of the others could have spent the night like this, alone with a girl, without forcing himself on her. She frowned. Steve had done something in the night, she recalled vaguely. Something nice. Yes. She had a dreamy memory of big hands rhythmically caressing her hair. It seemed, for a long time, while she dozed, as comfortable as a stroked cat. She smiled and stirred, and he spoke immediately. Are you awake? She yawned and stretched. I'm sorry I fell asleep on you. Are you okay? The blood supply to my left leg was cut off at about 5 a.m., but once I got used to that, I was fine. She sat upright so that she could see him better. His clothes were creased, his hair was mussed, and he had a growth of fair stubble, but he looked good enough to eat. Did you sleep? He shook his head. I was enjoying myself too much, watching you. Don't say I snore. You don't snore. You dribble a little, that's all. He dabbed at a damp spot on his pants. Oh, gross! She stood up. The bright blue clock on the wall caught her eye. It was 8:30. We don't have much time, she said in alarm. The hearing starts at 10. You shower while I make coffee, Steve said generously. She stared at him. He was unreal. Did you come from Santa Claus? He laughed. According to your theory, I come from a test tube. Then his face went solemn again. What the hell? Who knows? Her mood darkened along with his. She went into the bedroom, dropped her clothes on the floor, and got into the shower. As she washed her hair, she brooded over how hard she had struggled over the last 10 years. The contest for scholarships, the intensive tennis training combined with long hours of study, the peevish nitpicking of her doctoral supervisor. She had worked like a robot to get where she was today, all because she wanted to be a scientist and help the human race understand itself better. And now, Barrington Jones was about to throw it all away. The shower made her feel better. As she was toweling her hair, the phone rang. She picked up the bedside extension. Yeah? Jeannie, it's Patty. Hi, sis. What's happening? Daddy showed up. Jeannie sat on the bed. How is he? Broke, but healthy. He came to me first, Jeannie said. He arrived on Monday. Tuesday, he got a little ticked off because I didn't cook him dinner. Wednesday, he took off with my computer and my TV and my stereo. He must have already spent or gambled whatever he got for them. Patty gasped. Oh, Jeannie, that's awful. Ain't it just? So lock up your valuables. To steal from his own family. Oh, God, if Zip finds out, he'll throw him out. Patty, I have even worse problems. I may be fired from my job today. Jeannie, why? I don't have time to explain now, but I'll call you later. Okay. Have you talked to Mom? Every day. Oh, good. That makes me feel better. I talked to her once, then the next time I called, she was at lunch. The people who answer the phone are really unhelpful. We have to get Mom out of there soon. She'll be there a lot longer if I get fired today. I'll talk to you later. Good luck. Jeannie hung up. She noticed there was a steaming mug of coffee on the bedside table. She shook her head in amazement. It was only a cup of coffee, but what astonished her was the way Steve knew what she needed. It seemed to come naturally to him to be supportive, and he didn't want anything in return. In her experience, on the rare occasions when a man put a woman's needs ahead of his own, he expected her to act like a geisha for a month in gratitude. Steve was different. If I'd known men came in this version, I would have ordered one years ago. She had done everything alone, all her adult life. Her father had never been around to support her. Mom had always been strong, but in the end, her strength had become almost as much a problem as Daddy's weakness. Mom had plans for Jeannie, and she was not willing to give them up. She wanted Jeannie to be a hairdresser. She'd even got Jeannie a job 2 weeks before her 16th birthday, washing hair and sweeping the floor at the Salon Alexis in Adams Morgan. Jeannie's desire to be a scientist was utterly incomprehensible to her. "You should be a qualified stylist before the other girls have graduated college," Mom had said. She never understood why Jeannie threw a tantrum and refused even to take a look at the salon. She was not alone today. She had Steve to support her. It did not matter to her that he was not qualified. A hotshot Washington lawyer was not necessarily the best choice to impress 5 professors. The important thing was that he would be there. She put on her bathrobe and called to him. "You want the shower?" "Sure." He came into the bedroom. "I wish I had a clean shirt." "I don't have a man's shirt." "Wait a minute, I do." She had remembered the white Ralph Lauren button-down Lisa had borrowed after the fire. It belonged to someone in the math department. Jeannie had sent it to the laundry, and now it was in the closet, wrapped in cellophane. She gave it to Steve. "My size, 1736, he said. "Perfect. Don't ask me where it came from. It's a long story," she said. "I think I have a tie here somewhere, too." She opened a drawer and took out a blue silk spotted tie she sometimes wore with a white blouse, for a snappy, mannish look. "Here." "Thanks." He went into the tiny bathroom. She felt a twinge of disappointment. She had been looking forward to seeing him take off his shirt. Men, she thought. The creeps expose themselves without being asked. The hunks are as shy as nuns. "Can I borrow your razor?" he called. "Sure, be my guest." Memo to self. Do sex with this guy before he becomes too much like a brother. She looked for her best black suit, and remembered she had thrown it in the trash yesterday. Damn fool, she muttered to herself. She could probably retrieve it, but it would be creased and stained. She had a long-line electric blue jacket. She could wear that with a white T-shirt and black pants. It was a bit too bright, but it would serve. She sat at her mirror and did her makeup. Steve came out of the bathroom, looking handsomely formal in the shirt and tie. There are some cinnamon buns in the freezer, she said. You could defrost them in the microwave if you're hungry. Great, he said. You want something? I'm too tense to eat. I could drink another cup of coffee, though. He brought the coffee while she was finishing her makeup. She drank it quickly and put on her clothes. When she went into the living room, he was sitting at the kitchen counter. Did you find the buns? Sure. What happened to them? You said you weren't hungry, so I ate them all. All four? In fact, there were two packets. You ate eight cinnamon buns? He looked embarrassed. I get hungry. She laughed. Let's go. As she turned away, he grabbed her arm. 1 minute. What? Jeannie, it's fun being friends, and I really like just hanging out with you, you know. But you have to understand, this isn't all I want. I do know that. I'm falling in love with you. She looked into his eyes. He was very sincere. I'm getting kind of attached to you, too, she said lightly. I want to make love to you, and I want it so bad it hurts. I could listen to this kind of talk all day, she thought. Listen, she said. If you fuck like you eat, I'm yours. His face fell, and she realized she had said the wrong thing. I'm sorry, she said. I didn't mean to make a joke of it. He gave a never-mind shrug. She took his hand. Listen, first we're going to save me. Then we're going to save you. Then we'll have some fun. He squeezed her hand. Okay. They went outside. Let's drive together, she said. I'll bring you back to your car later. They got into her Mercedes. The car radio came on as she started the engine. Easing into the traffic on 41st Street, she heard the news announcer mention Genetico, and she turned up the volume. Senator Jim Proust, a former director of the CIA, is expected to confirm today he will seek the Republican nomination in next year's presidential election. His campaign promise, 10% income tax, paid for by the abolition of welfare. Campaign finance will not be a problem, commentators say, as he stands to make $60 million from an agreed takeover of his medical research company, Genetico. In sports, the Philadelphia Phillies... Jeannie switched off the radio. What do you think of that? Steve shook his head in dismay. The stakes keep getting higher, he said. If we break the true story of Genetico and the takeover bid is canceled, Jim Proust won't be able to pay for a presidential campaign. And Proust is a serious bad guy. A spook, ex-CIA, against gun control, everything. You're standing in the way of some dangerous people, Jeannie. She gritted her teeth. That makes them all the more worth fighting against. I was raised on welfare, Steve. If Proust becomes president, girls like me will always be hairdressers. 39. There was a small demonstration outside Hillside Hall, the administrative office building of Jones Falls University. 30 or 40 students, mostly women, stood in a cluster in front of the steps. It was a quiet, disciplined protest. Getting closer, Steve read a banner. Reinstate Farami now. It seemed like a good omen to him. They're supporting you, he said to Jeannie. She looked closer, and a flush of pleasure spread across her face. So they are. My God, someone loves me after all. Another placard read, You can't do this to J.F. A cheer went up when they spotted Jeannie. She went over to them, smiling. Steve followed, proud of her. Not every professor would get such spontaneous support from students. She shook hands with the men and kissed the women. Steve noticed a pretty blonde woman staring at him. Jeannie hugged an older woman in the crowd. Sophie, she said. What can I say? Good luck in there, the woman said. Jeannie detached herself from the crowd, beaming, and they walked toward the building. He said, Well, they think you should keep your job. I can't tell you how much that means to me, she said. That older woman is Sophie Chappell, a professor in the psychology department. I thought she hated me. I can't believe she's standing up for me. Who was the pretty girl at the front? Jeannie gave him a curious look. You don't recognize her? I'm pretty sure I've never seen her before, but she couldn't take her eyes off me. Then he guessed. Oh, my God, it must be the victim. Lisa Hoxton. No wonder she stared. He could not help glancing back. She was a pretty, lively-looking girl, small and rather plump. His double had attacked her and thrown her to the floor and forced her to have sex. A small knot of disgust twisted inside Steve. She was just an ordinary young woman, and now she had a nightmare memory that would haunt her all her life. The administrative building was a grand old house. Jeannie led him across the marbled hall and through a door marked Old Dining Room into a gloomy chamber in the baronial style. High ceiling, narrow Gothic windows, and thick-legged oak furniture. A long table stood in front of a carved stone fireplace. Four men and a middle-aged woman sat along one side of the table. Steve recognized the bald man in the middle as Jeannie's tennis opponent, Jack Budgeon. This was the committee, he presumed, the group that held Jeannie's fate in its hands. He took a deep breath. Leaning over the table, he shook Jack Budgeon's hand and said, "Good morning, Dr. Budgeon. I'm Stephen Logan. We spoke yesterday." Some instinct took over, and he found himself exuding a relaxed confidence that was the opposite of what he felt. He shook hands with each of the committee members, and they told him their names. Two more men sat on the near side of the table, at the far end. The little guy in the navy-vested suit was Barrington Jones, whom Steve had met last Monday. The thin, sandy-haired man in a charcoal double-breasted pinstripe had to be Henry Quinn. Steve shook hands with both. Quinn looked at him superciliously and said, "What are your legal qualifications, young man?" Steve gave him a friendly smile and spoke in a low voice that no one else could hear. "Go fuck yourself, Henry." Quinn flinched as if he had been struck, and Steve thought, "That will be the last time the old bastard condescends to me." He held a chair for Jeannie, and they both sat down. "Well, perhaps we should begin," Jack said. "These proceedings are informal. I believe everyone has received a copy of the rubric, so we know the rules. The charge is laid by Professor Barrington Jones, who proposes that Dr. Jean Ferrani be dismissed because she has brought Jones Falls University into disrepute." As Budgeon spoke, Steve watched the committee members, looking eagerly for signs of sympathy. He was not reassured. Only the woman, Jane Edelsborough, would look at Jeannie. The others did not meet her eyes. Four against, one in favor at the start, he thought. It was not good. Jack said, "Barrington is represented by Mr. Quinn." Quinn got to his feet and opened his briefcase. Steve noticed that his fingers were stained yellow from cigarettes. He took out a sheaf of blow-up photocopies of the New York Times piece about Jeannie and handed one to every person in the room. The result was that the table was covered with pieces of paper saying, "Jean Research Ethics, Doubts, Fears, and a Squabble." It was a powerful visual reminder of the trouble Jeannie had caused. Steve wished he had brought some papers to give out so that he could have covered up Quinn's. This simple, effective opening move by Quinn intimidated Steve. How could he possibly compete with a man who had probably 30 years of courtroom experience? "I can't win this," he thought in a sudden panic. Quinn began to speak. His voice was dry and precise, with no trace of a local accent. He spoke slowly and pedantically. Steve hoped that might be a mistake with this jury of intellectuals who did not need things spelled out for them in words of one syllable. Quinn summarized the history of the Discipline Committee and explained its position in the university government. He defined disrepute and produced a copy of Jeannie's employment contract. Steve began to feel better as Quinn droned on. At last he wound up his preamble and started to question Barrington. He began by asking when Barrington had first heard about Jeannie's computer search program. "Last Monday afternoon," Barrington replied. He recounted the conversation he and Jeannie had had. His story tallied with what Jeannie had told Steve. Then Barrington said, "As soon as I clearly understood her technique, I told her that, in my opinion, what she was doing was illegal." Jeannie burst out, "What?" Quinn ignored her and asked Barrington, And what was her reaction? She became very angry.
You damn liar,
Jeannie said. Barrington flushed at this accusation. Jack Budgeon intervened. Please, no interruptions, he said. Steve kept an eye on the committee. They had all looked at Jeannie. They could hardly help it. He put a hand on her arm as if restraining her.
He's telling barefaced lies, she protested.
What did you expect? Steve said in a low voice. He's playing hardball. I'm sorry, she whispered. Don't be, he said in her ear. Keep it up. They could see your anger was genuine. Barrington went on. She became petulant, just as she is now. She told me she could do what she liked. She had a contract. One of the men on the committee, Tennille Bidenham, frowned darkly, obviously disliking the idea of a junior member of faculty quoting her contract to her professor. Barrington was clever, Steve realized. He knew how to take a point scored against him and turn it to his advantage. Quinn asked Barrington, What did you do? Well, I realized I might be wrong. I'm not a lawyer, so I decided to get legal advice. If my fears were confirmed, I could show her independent proof. But if it turned out that what she was doing was harmless, I could drop the matter without a confrontation. And did you take advice? As things turned out, I was overtaken by events. Before I had a chance to see a lawyer, the New York Times got on the case. Jeannie whispered, Bullshit. Are you sure? Steve asked her. Positive. He made a note. Tell us what happened on Wednesday, please, Quinn said to Barrington. My worst fears came true. The university president, Maurice O'Bell, summoned me to his office and asked me to explain why he was getting aggressive phone calls from the press about the research in my department. We drafted a press announcement as a basis for discussion and called in Dr. Ferrami. Jesus Christ, muttered Jeannie. Barrington went on. She refused to talk about the press release. Once again, she blew her top, insisted she could do what she liked, and stormed out. Steve looked in inquiry at Jeannie. She said in a low voice, A clever lie. They presented me with the press announcement as a fait accompli. Steve nodded, but he decided not to take up this point in cross-examination. The committee would probably feel Jeannie should not have stormed out anyway. The reporter told us she had a deadline of noon that day. Barrington continued smoothly. Dr. O'Bell felt the university had to say something decisive, and I must say I agreed with him 100%. And did your announcement have the effect you hoped for? No, it was a total failure, but that was because it was completely undermined by Dr. Ferrami. She told the reporter that she intended to ignore us, and there was nothing we could do about it. Did anyone outside the university comment on the story? They certainly did. Something about the way Barrington answered that question rang a warning bell in Steve's head, and he made a note. I got a phone call from Preston Bark, the president of Genetico, which is an important donor to the university, and in particular funds the entire twins research program. Barrington continued. He was naturally concerned about the way his money was being spent. The article made it look as if the university authorities were impotent. Preston said to me, Who's running the damn school anyway? It was very embarrassing. Was that your principal concern, the embarrassment of having been defied by a junior member of the faculty? Certainly not. The main problem was the damage to Jones Falls that would be caused by Dr. Ferrami's work. Nice move, Steve thought. In their hearts, all the committee members would hate to be defied by an assistant professor, and Barrington had drawn their sympathy. But Quinn had moved quickly to put the whole complaint on a more high-minded level so that they could tell themselves that by firing Jeannie, they would be protecting the university, not just punishing a disobedient subordinate. Barrington said, A university should be sensitive to privacy issues. Donors give us money, and students compete for places here, because this is one of the nation's most venerable educational institutions. The suggestion that we are careless with people's civil rights is very damaging. It was a quietly eloquent formulation, and all the panel would approve. Steve nodded to show that he agreed too, hoping they would notice and conclude that this was not the question at issue. Quinn asked Barrington, So how many options faced you at that point? Exactly one. We had to show that we did not sanction invasion of privacy by university researchers. We also needed to demonstrate that we had the authority to enforce our own rules. The way to do that was to fire Dr. Ferrami. There was no alternative. Thank you, Professor, said Quinn, and he sat down. Steve felt pessimistic. Quinn was every bit as skillful as expected. Barrington had been dreadfully plausible. He had presented a picture of a reasonable, concerned human being doing his best to deal with a hot-tempered, careless subordinate. It was the more credible for having a lacing of reality. Jeannie was quick-tempered. But it was not the truth. That was all Steve had going for him. Jeannie was in the right. He just had to prove it. Jack Budgeon said, Have you any questions, Mr. Logan? I sure do, said Steve. He paused for a moment, collecting his thoughts. This was his fantasy. He was not in a courtroom, and he was not even a real lawyer, but he was defending an underdog against the injustice of a mighty institution. The odds were against him, but truth was on his side. It was what he dreamed about. He stood up and looked hard at Barrington. If Jeannie's theory was right, the man had to feel strange in this situation. It must be like Dr. Frankenstein being questioned by his monster. Steve wanted to play on that a little, to shake Barrington's composure before starting on the material questions. You know me, don't you, Professor? Steve said. Barrington looked unnerved. I believe we met on Monday, yes. And you know all about me. I don't quite follow you. I underwent a day of tests in your laboratory, so you have a great deal of information on me. I see what you mean. Yes. Barrington looked thoroughly discomfited. Steve moved behind Jeannie's chair so that they would all have to look at her. It was much harder to think evil of someone who returned your gaze with an open, fearless expression. Professor, let me begin with the first claim you made, that you intended to seek legal advice after your conversation with Dr. Ferrami on Monday. Yes. You didn't actually see a lawyer. No, I was overtaken by events. You didn't make an appointment to see a lawyer. There wasn't time. In the 2 days between your conversation with Dr. Ferrami and your conversation with Dr. O'Bell about the New York Times, you didn't even ask your secretary to make an appointment with a lawyer. No. Nor did you ask around, or speak to any of your colleagues to find out the name of someone suitable. No. In fact, you're quite unable to substantiate this claim. Barrington smiled confidently. However, I have a reputation as an honest man. Dr. Ferrami recalls the conversation very vividly. Good. She says you made no mention of legal problems or privacy worries. Your only concern was whether the search engine worked. Perhaps she's forgotten. Or perhaps you've misremembered. Steve felt he had won that point, and he changed tack abruptly. Did the New York Times reporter, Ms. Freelander, say how she heard about Dr. Ferrami's work? If she did, Dr. O'Bell never mentioned it to me. So you didn't ask? No. Did it occur to you to wonder how she knew? I guess I assumed that reporters have their sources. Since Dr. Ferrami hasn't published anything about this project, the source must have been an individual. Barrington hesitated and looked to Quinn for guidance.